I knew how Jeremiah died. I knew how Paul Nadler's body made its way to the river in Stanton. I knew how that white F-150 had been abandoned at Shelby Lake without anyone coming to pick up the driver. There was just one man behind all of it. One man with a motorcycle.
Shelby?
Monica asked me.
Who took Breezy home that night?
A well-meaning traveler, I replied. I woke up Agent Reed at the motel. It had been the Avery Ware Inn since Rose sold it, but we all still called it the Rest in Peace. I saw a laptop open on the bed in Reed's room, but his eyes were heavy, as if he'd fallen asleep while working.
Shelby,
he said in surprise with a glance at his watch.
Is everything okay?
No. No, I don't think so. I have a question for you. Do you remember that voicemail that Adam left for you when you came to town the first time? The one that almost got him fired?
Of course,
Reed replied with a roll of his eyes. This will sound strange, but do you still have it? He gave me a puzzled look.
Well, I'm sure we have it archived somewhere. Trust me, the FBI saves everything. It would take me a few minutes to find on our server, though. Why? What is this about?
I need to listen to it again. Reed read the expression on my face. He was wide awake now.
Okay, let me see what I can do.
He retrieved his laptop from the bed and relocated it to a circular table near the window. He sat down and began tapping the keys. I closed the motel room door behind me, shutting out the winter air. Reed gave me a sideways glance as he typed.
So are you going to tell me what this is about?
Drunk driving. I'm pretty sure that's what this is about. His fingers stopped over the keys.
What?
No kidnapping. No abuse. Just drunk driving. Reed didn't push me to explain. He turned his eyes down to the keyboard and focused on his laptop again. It took him only a few minutes to find the archived recording of Adam's voicemail. The timestamp was just before 1 a.m. on that early Sunday morning 10 years ago. He called me over to listen, and then he played it for me. I'd heard the message once before, but I barely remembered what Adam had said. I only knew it had been bad, and it was.
Special Agent Reed, this is Deputy Adam Twilley. Just thought I'd check in with you after a really productive day checking the toilets of campgrounds around here. Yeah, thanks a lot for the vote of confidence. I bet you thought that was funny. I bet you guys had a good laugh about that. Man, you Phoebes really think you're rock stars, huh? You think you're so much better than a bunch of rubes like us in the sticks. Well, you know what? You're all just a...
I held up my hand to make Reed stop the playback. There was no need to go on. I confess, I cleaned up what Adam had said. It was much, much worse, filled with insults and F-bombs. The fact is, I wasn't really listening to Adam's slurred, drunken voice. I was listening to the background. Did you hear it? Reed looked at me.
Hear what?
The music. He played it again, and this time he heard it too. It was music from a car radio, close by, so close that Adam had to be practically on top of it. Mick Jagger was croaking out Under My Thumb. The music is coming from the F-150, I said. Adam was there. He was at the resort. Chapter 45. At daybreak, I asked Adam to meet me. The morning was cold and clear at the old Middle Pines Resort. With barely a murmur of wind, every branch in the trees was still. The winter gray had vanished and left the clearing under blue skies, making the bed of snow sparkle like a field of diamonds. I hiked through calf-deep powder into the middle of the meadow and found a fallen tree trunk. I brushed off the snow and sat down. I waited. Adam arrived 10 minutes later. I watched him come. He wore his uniform and his hat like shields that he could hide behind. He was the sheriff, but to me he looked like a boy again, impulsive and reckless. I could see now what the years and the guilt had done to him. I tried to imagine what it was like to keep a terrible secret for so long and to see it reflected in your own eyes whenever you looked in a mirror. As he came close to me, I watched him try to decode my own face. Did I know? He stood over me and squinted into the sun. His shadow stretched behind him.
Shelby?
Hello, Adam.
What's up? Why the early meeting?
I have a question.
Yeah? What is it?
I want to know if it was an accident. He tried to keep his cool, but his whole body stiffened.
What are you talking about?
Not Jeremiah, I said. I know he was an accident. I'm talking about Breezy. Did you mean to do it? Was it deliberate? Or did you simply get angry and push her, and she fell?
Is this a joke?
Oh, no. No joke. What was the problem? Did she want you to pay her to keep quiet? Violet says Breezy wasn't above a little blackmail. She needed money, and you've got a lot of it. Adam shook his head, but he was a terrible actor. He was trembling down to his boots.
I think you've had a stroke, Shelby. We should get you some help.
I stood up from the fallen tree, and we were eye to eye. When I asked Breezy who went home with her on that Saturday night 10 years ago, she was about to say it was you, right? You took her home on your motorcycle. But she stopped and didn't say anything when she saw you flinch. Did she realize that you didn't want her to tell me? She must have wondered why. When you came back later, had she already figured it out? Did she threaten to expose you? So the two of you argued. You grabbed her by the shoulders, you shoved her, and she fell and hit her head. I really hope it was an accident. Breezy was my friend. I don't want to think you went over there to kill her.
We're done here, Shelby. I'm leaving.
No, you're not going anywhere, Sheriff. I need to tell you a story.
What kind of story?
I'm going to tell you what happened to Jeremiah. Agent Reed and I spent most of the night working out the details. Yes, he knows all about it, too. We must be pretty close to the truth, but you can stop me if I get anything wrong, okay? Adam stared at me with hollow, empty eyes and said nothing. We know about Paul Nadler taking the F-150 and meeting up with Jeremiah. I bet they liked each other immediately. The old man, the young boy. Nadler probably asked him if he knew where this old resort was, and Jeremiah said, "Sure, I know that place," and off they went. They drove here. Right here. It must have been an adventure for Jeremiah. Hunting for rocks, playing with his badminton racket, putting Legos together, playing the radio on the pickup truck. I'm sure he was thinking he'd have a great story to tell when he got home. I glanced over my shoulder at the cabin where the two of them had stayed. It was winter now. It was summer then. But Anna was right. Suddenly I could feel Jeremiah all over this place. Friday was fun, but I bet Saturday was when the fun started to wear off. Jeremiah started getting lonely. Hungry, too. I don't imagine he had much to eat in his backpack. His phone was dead. He was missing his family and wondering what to do. I don't know exactly when Paul Nadler had his heart attack, but at some point, Jeremiah must have realized that this sweet old man was gone, just like his own grandfather. All of a sudden, the adventure began to get scary. And when it got dark on Saturday and a thunderstorm came roaring in, that poor kid, he must have been terrified. Probably the only thing that helped was listening to the radio on the truck, but he'd had the engine running for hours. It must have been getting pretty low on gas. I feel bad, thinking about him all alone, hiding in the cabin, wondering if anyone would ever find him. I stared into Adam's eyes. But someone did. You found him. Out of the stillness, a single gust of wind whipped across the meadow and took Adam's hat off his head. It rolled away on top of the snow like an old tire. Adam made no attempt to retrieve it. Saturday was a rotten day for you, I went on. I get that. You were doing grunt work for the FBI. You were tired, you were pissed off, you smelled like campground toilets. So you spent the evening drinking at the Nowhere Cafe and pouring out your problems to Breezy. And when the diner finally closed, you took her home. She rode on the back of your bike in the pouring rain. Not smart, Adam. You were already pretty drunk. You could have both been killed. But you made it to her trailer. What did you do when you got there? Did you drink more? Or did Breezy share any of her other stash with you? Meth? Cocaine? Heroin? Did you sleep with her? Or were you too drunk and riled to make it to bed? That probably made you feel worse. Now you were really angry. So when the rain stopped, you told Breezy you were heading home. She came outside with you and she heard the music. Rock and roll radio blaring over the trees for hours, just like the previous night. She was sure it was the Gruders. She asked you to go over there and tell them to knock it off, and that's what you did. You drove your motorcycle down the dirt road, but pretty soon you realized it couldn't be the Gruders. The music was coming from the other direction. And that's when you headed to the old resort. It was all so vivid. I knew Adam. I could see him parking at the end of that road and following the music toward the cabins like a siren. He must have suspected what he would find there. He must have realized that he was going to be a hero. What a combination of alcohol and adrenaline would have been pumping through his bloodstream. You came up here and you saw it. There it was, the white F-150. Did you call out Jeremiah's name? No, probably not. You still thought he'd been kidnapped. You figured whoever did it was still around. So you searched through the cabins, and you found him. Safe. Alive. Alone except for that poor old man, dead on the moldy mattress. Did Jeremiah run to you? Did he hug you? Wow. What a moment that must have been, Adam. Really. I know how exhilarated you must have felt. All these people searching, all these out-of-towners, all the national media, all the feds treating you like dirt, and you found Jeremiah. You. All by yourself. You were going to be on television. I mean real television. New York talk shows. Magazine covers, too. Probably a movie. You were going to be famous. I felt my words catching in my throat. I didn't like doing this to him. I really didn't. That's when you left the voicemail for Agent Reed, right? I can hear it in your voice when I listen to it. That smug triumph. You were going to show all of them, all of those arrogant feds. Except you were drunk, and you were impatient. You should have called for backup, Adam. One phone call to my father, and then you wait there with Jeremiah until the cavalry arrives. But that wasn't good enough for you, was it? You weren't going to let anybody else take that boy home. You were going to do it yourself. You were going to drive him right up to his house and put him in his mother's arms. Nobody else. Not my father, not me, certainly not Agent Reed. Deputy Adam Twilley was going to save the day. But there was hardly any gas left in the pickup, was there? It was pretty much empty by then. So you said to Jeremiah, "How about the two of us take a ride? You ever ridden on a motorcycle?" I looked at the stricken pain on Adam's face. I knew I'd gotten it exactly right. You could feel that boy's arms clenched around your waist as you rode. You must have been flying. You were thinking about your future and how this was going to change your life. You were thinking what it was going to be like when Ellen Sloan saw her son again. You were thinking about all those media people interviewing you and taking your picture. You were thinking about everything except what you should have been thinking about. The road. The wet pavement. The bike. You took one of the curves too fast. Is that how it went down? The bike spun out? You fell. Jeremiah fell. You got up, but he didn't. I shook my head. I'm trying to imagine the horror you felt, Adam, and I can't. I just can't. One split second, and all those dreams turned to nightmares. You'd found our boy, and now instead of rescuing him, you'd killed him. You weren't going to be the hero anymore. You were going to be hated. Everyone in town, in the state, in the country would know your name. Adam Twilley. The drunken deputy who let a missing boy die on his motorcycle. You were going to lose your job. You were going to jail. Your life was over. You were in a panic. What do? You can't let anyone know what happened. Nobody can know Jeremiah or Paul Nadler were anywhere near that resort. You had to cover it all up. I pictured him standing over the boy's dead body on the road, dragging him down the shoulder into the woods, coming up with a desperate plan. You needed gasoline for the truck. So you rode back to Breezy's, right? You figured she'd have a tank in her shed. Except in the middle of doing that, you heard somebody outside the trailer. Dennis Sloan. He felt you watching him. He was sure someone was there. But you were lucky. He didn't find you. He left, and then you took the gas tank and went back to the resort to get the truck. You had to move fast. You needed to get everything done while it was still dark. You tried to hide any evidence that Jeremiah had been there, but you were in a hurry. There were things you missed, things you didn't know about. The rocks, the Legos, the lost shuttlecock in the chimney. You filled up the gas tank of the truck, and you put Mr. Nadler's body in the back, and you put your motorcycle in the flatbed. Then you went back to where Jeremiah was waiting for you. Was there a shovel in the pickup, or did you take one from Breezy's shed? Either way, you buried him. You dug through the wet ground and buried him. Do you still remember the place where you did it? I don't think you forget something like that. I hope you remember, because you're going to take us there, Adam. His breaths were coming faster and faster. His eyes darted back and forth, as if he could find a way to escape if he looked hard enough. I pressed on. Then all that was left was to get rid of Paul Nadler and the truck. So you drove all the way across the county to Stanton. It was a long way to go, but that was the safest bet, right? Put Mr. Nadler in the river not far from his nursing home. Everyone would assume he'd wandered away on foot and died. But the truck? The truck couldn't be anywhere nearby. You didn't want anyone to connect Nadler to the F-150. So after that, you went over to Shelby Lake and wiped down the truck and left it behind. Then you took your motorcycle, and you drove home. Adam didn't look at me. His gaze wandered across the field, following his hat as it blew away toward the trees. When he finally said something, he was the old Adam, the arrogant James Dean Adam, the hero with the inferiority complex.
That's a hell of a story, Shelby.
It's a true story, right?
I'm a cop. I know the difference between evidence and speculation. I know when somebody has proof and when somebody has nothing.
Oh, I wouldn't count on that, Adam. We'll be able to prove you were at the resort because we've got the voicemail to Agent Reed. And when we search along the road between here and Witchtree, sooner or later we're going to find Jeremiah. Even after all this time, the FBI forensics team will find something to connect him to you and your bike. Count on it. But you can save us the trouble. You can admit what you did right now.
Why would I do that?
Because you've been living with the guilt for 10 years and it's killing you. The only thing that will make it go away is to admit the truth. The only way to save yourself is to give up the secret. Tell me the truth, Adam. Tell us the truth.
Us?
I gestured over his shoulder. Adam turned around. They were all there in the snow behind him, their faces grim. Ellen. Dennis. Adrian. Agent Reed. They stood there watching him like a silent jury. We're here so you can take us to Jeremiah, I said. Don't you think it's about time, Adam? It's time for him to come home. Tell us where he is. Adam tried to say something, but nothing came out of his mouth. He swallowed hard. He sucked his upper lip between his teeth and bit down. He blinked over and over until he blinked out a single tear that ran down his red cheeks. His fingers clenched into fists. Please, Adam, take us there. He staggered away from me through the drifts. He didn't run. He knew there was nowhere to go. No one said a word. The Sloanes were quiet. So was Agent Reed. No one made any attempt to stop him. I followed in his footsteps. We hiked through the clearing and back into the trees and down to the turnaround at the end of the dirt road. Adam went to his car. I saw him freeze outside the driver's door. He squeezed his head with both hands as if he could shut out the memories flooding through his mind. Then he looked back at me, and our eyes met, and he gave me an expression that must be like a drowning man when his lungs run out of air. Adam got in his car. I got in mine. I knew where we were going. The two of us headed down the dirt road in tandem back toward Witchtree. Adam drove slowly, letting me trail behind him in the ruts his car made. We went around a sharp curve, then another, and another. And then ahead of us, the road straightened for half a mile. At the end of the straightaway was a swooping S-curve with a sign warning drivers to slow down. I heard the roar of the engine in front of me. Adam accelerated his cruiser like a jet unleashing its engines on the runway. His tires squealed, and the car fishtailed as he built up speed. Snow shot up in clouds behind him. I thought for a moment he was trying to escape, but he wasn't. The reality of what he was doing dawned on me, and I lowered my window and shouted, "No, no, no, don't do it!" He was too far away to hear me. I sped up too, but I couldn't catch him. Adam rocketed down the straightaway. His brake lights never flashed, not once. The bend of the S-curve loomed ahead of him, but he didn't slow down or turn the wheel. The cruiser burst through the snow and took flight, shooting off the road, lifting off the ground and jolting to a lethal stop an instant later as it slammed into the trees beyond the curve. I heard the tortured squeal of metal and the shatter of glass. I brought my own car to a stop and I got out and ran. The shoulder of the road dipped down to the frozen creek 10 feet below me. I half slid, half fell into the valley. Adam's car was upside down among the trees, its tires still spinning. Steam hissed into the air. I pushed toward the wreck and squatted to look inside, but the front seat was empty. I peered through the skeletal branches and saw Adam crumpled on the ground not far away. He'd gone through the windshield like a bullet. When I reached him, I knew that he was already dead. His face was ribboned with blood. His head was snapped sideways like a broken doll's. He was warm, but he was gone. I listened to the loud, fast in and out of my own breathing. My sweat was wet and cold, and my feet inside my boots were soaked. Around me, the forest continued its winter sleep, undisturbed. There was nothing but me and the trees and the snow and the creek, but I wasn't alone. I had the strangest feeling of someone being with me, of someone who'd been waiting for me to arrive. I turned around in a slow circle. No one was there, but squeezed among the oaks and pines was a stand of birch trees, their bark flaking away like old paint, their black and white trunks rooted in the ground like the legs of elephants. One of the thick birches called to me, and I fought through the snow to get to it. That was when I saw the sign. A cross had been carved into the trunk. 10 years ago, it must have been invisible among the summer foliage, just two slim gashes cut out of the bark. But it had grown along with the tree. As the trunk bulged and thickened, so did the cross, begging for someone to notice it and understand what it was. My body felt enveloped by a warm glow, even among the frigid cold. The earth at my feet felt sacred. Someone was buried below me, and I knew who it was. Chapter 46. 10 years after Jeremiah Sloan disappeared, we finally brought him home. With the help of propane fires and insulated blankets, we melted the frost in the ground and dug carefully through the soft soil at the base of the birch tree. 3 feet down, we found the skeleton of a child. Adam had buried Jeremiah with his arms folded across his chest. If it was possible for bones to look peaceful, then his body looked as if it had been at peace all this time. His Sunday suit had long ago disintegrated, leaving behind only the leather and rusted buckle of his belt and the rubber remnants of the sneakers on his feet. He still wore his backpack. Parts of it, the zippers, the thick vinyl, the plastic-encased pockets, had survived the freezing, thawing, moisture, and bugs. His badminton racket was caked with dirt but otherwise intact. His dead cell phone was safely locked inside a zippered pocket and a boy-proof, indestructible case. Agent Reed took it for analysis by the FBI team. If any photos could be retrieved from Jeremiah's phone, I wanted his parents to have them. We were at the scene for most of 3 days. The time was reverent for all of us. The Sloanes were there, all three of them, when we brought their boy into the light again. We kept the media away so that they could have a private moment with him. From where I was, I saw Adrian whisper something to his brother, and I was pretty sure he said, "Welcome back." Ellen and Dennis held hands and hugged each other fiercely. The love of that moment wouldn't last, but for a little while anyway, they cried the tears of a family that had been reunited. On the last day, as Jeremiah was brought back to everywhere, I thought about the first day when he disappeared. Strange as it sounds, my father had been right all along. He hadn't believed in a stranger abduction. He'd had faith that the people here were basically good and that we would find an innocent explanation at the heart of the mystery. And we did. Sadly, it came without a happy ending. 3 weeks later, Jeremiah finally had his funeral, and we all got to say goodbye. It seemed as if the whole state came. Thousands of people braved the cold for hours to pay their respects. The bend in the road where he'd waited for us to find him became a shrine, covered over with flowers freezing into brittle china. His face and smile no longer haunted us from missing person photos the way they had for years. He had a permanent home. Before the public service, the Sloanes held a small memorial of their own at their church. They wanted to say thank you to the town and to the police for never giving up hope. The minister spoke. Ellen, Dennis, and Adrian spoke. And then they went from person to person to shake every hand. We all cried, but the tears were cathartic, letting go of 10 years of pain. When Ellen came to me, she slipped something into my hand. I looked at my palm and saw a smooth, flat stone, the kind of stone you'd place among the rocks of a cairn to honor the dead. "I kept this stone in my pocket every day for the past 10 years, Ellen whispered to me. "It came from Jeremiah's room. I swore I would never let go of it until we found him. And now we have, thanks to you. I want you to keep it." I tried to say something, but I had no words. Ellen kissed my cheek, and she moved on. It was a day of closure for all of us. Lucas was there, apologizing to the Sloanes for what his grandfather had done. Dennis Sloan wrapped him up in a bear hug and told him that God hadn't wanted Paul Nadler to be alone when he died, and that was why he'd brought Jeremiah to him. I'd like to believe that's true. Agent Reed was there. So was Monica, carrying Moody in his urn. And Rose, and Violet, and Jeannie Samper and all of her kids. And Dad, looking handsome in his suit. I wished he could understand that the long mystery had come to an end, but he was already deep into his own mystery. Everyone was there except the one person I wanted to see. Every time the door opened, I kept hoping, but the service began and ended without her. Anna didn't come. Later that same day, my own life took a turn I wasn't expecting. I was back at the Nowhere Cafe with Monica and Dad, and Violet came through the door and made her way straight to the booth where we were sitting. She sat down next to my father, and he smiled and called her young lady because he didn't remember who she was. Violet nodded at Monica, who didn't look at all surprised to see her there.
Deputy Lake,
she said to me. I tried not to roll my eyes at the formal greeting. Hello, Violet.
I know the Congresswoman has already thanked you, but I wanted to say thank you myself for everything you did on her behalf.
That's not necessary, but I appreciate it. And I did. Violet and I were never going to be friends, but she was looking at me with something I'd never seen from her before. Respect.
Obviously, I'm not on the county board anymore, she went on, but my former colleagues thought I'd be the best person to sound you out about something.
Oh, what's that? Violet took another quick glance at Monica before focusing on me again.
The board would like you to consider an appointment as interim sheriff. They also wanted you to know that if you'd consider running for the position in the November election, you'd have their full support.
Me? Sheriff?
Well, you've pretty much been filling the role anyway since Adam's death, Violet pointed out, so I assume you've thought about it.
In fact, I hadn't thought about it at all. I know I should have, but I really hadn't had time to think about the future. There were too many details filling up the present. The trouble was, now that the opportunity was staring me in the face, I did think about it, and I knew what my answer had to be. Tell the board how much I appreciate their confidence, I replied. But no.
No?
I'm sorry, no. I'd love to do it, but I can't. Violet didn't ask me why. She seemed to know why. She got out of the booth and then bent down and put a hand on my father's shoulder.
Tom? Mr. Ginn, I wonder if you'd mind giving me just a moment alone with Shelby and Monica. Would that be okay?
Violet, I said in protest, but Dad simply slid his big body out of the booth.
Why, certainly. I know how women like to chat.
I watched him make his way to the counter, where Patty brought him a slice of Toll House pie. Violet sat down across from me again.
I assume Tom's the reason?
Yes, I said matter-of-factly.
You have your own life to live, Shelby.
I know that, but my father is everything to me. I'm not going to put him in a facility. I'm going to take care of him myself. Violet shook her head.
At some point, you won't have a choice.
Well, for right now, I do, and my choice is to be with him. I can't do that and be sheriff at the same time. It's hard enough the way things are.
You could get help,
Violet said.
You could find someone to live with you and look after Tom when you're gone.
I had to laugh. Live in help? Are you kidding? Do you know how much that costs? As I said this, Monica reached over and took my hand. It was as if she'd been waiting for that moment.
In fact, Shelby, it will cost you nothing at all.
What do you mean? She continued to hold my hand with the calmness of someone who would never let go.
I'm quitting my job, dear. It's time for me to retire. If you can find a place for me, and Moody, of course, then let me move in with you and Tom. That's where my heart is. That's where I can be most useful at this stage of my life. With me around, I think you should be able to balance your career and your devotion to your father, don't you think?
The offer took my breath away. I shook my head and tried not to cry. Monica, I can't believe you. I don't know what to say.
Say yes,
she replied.
And say yes to Violet.
I don't know if this will work, I said. It's still too much.
Well, we won't know until we try, will we?
I guess that's true.
Tom always wanted you to be the sheriff.
I know he did.
If you're honest with yourself, I think you'll realize that you've wanted this too. And you'll be good at it. Truth be told, you were made to do this, Shelby. Everyone I talk to in town says the same thing. They all want you.
She's right, Violet said. I glanced at my father, who was sitting at the counter with his cup of coffee and his pie. Yes, this was what he'd always wanted for me. And yes, as a girl, I'd imagined the day when Dad would hand me his badge and I would take over. I just never thought the circumstances would be like this. I extended my arm to Violet and we shook hands. Okay, I can't promise to run in November. Let's see how the year goes. But for now, you can tell the board I'll take the interim post. Violet looked pleased with herself. She had a way of getting what she wanted, and I was pretty sure she'd work this all out with Monica in advance.
Congratulations, Shelby, she said. You're the new sheriff of Middle County.
Chapter 47. Slowly, the town of Everywhere exhaled. The media and the strangers went away and left us alone. February became March, and the snow began to melt. March became April, and buds appeared on the trees. Life returned to normal day by day. My own life was a constant juggling act, but Monica and I became master jugglers. Somehow I found time to wear my many hats. I was a daughter, I was a sheriff, I was a volunteer helping Lucas and Jeannie with the owls. I was a girl with a guitar. I had everything I needed, but I couldn't get past my biggest disappointment. You see, I'd lost Anna. I'd failed. Yes, I'd wrested her away from Will Gruder. She was back home with me, but the fire had gone out of her eyes. I actually missed her defiance. Ever since we'd found Jeremiah's body, she'd become an empty shell, drained of passion. Her father, Carl, reached out to her, but she pushed him out of her life the way she did everyone who tried to help her. She wouldn't go to therapy. Her drinking got worse, and the physical signs told me she was using drugs, too, as if the chemicals would deaden her. She was a beautiful girl, only 20 years old, but she acted as if her life was over. I tried to talk to her, but she simply dug a hole for herself that got deeper each day. Now that Jeremiah was safe, it seemed as if Anna was the one buried in the woods. Sometimes the dead are easier to find than the living. This went on for weeks. I was losing hope that it would ever change. Then on May 1st, I brought home a package from Agent Reed, and I thought what was inside might be what I needed to open up a little door into Anna's heart. It was like a message from her childhood. Midnight had come and gone by the time I got home that day. I often got back late in my new job. Thank God for Monica, who put up with my hours without a single complaint and was always there for Dad. I checked on both of them. Monica was asleep in her room with Moody on the nightstand beside her, and my father was asleep in his. But I knew that Anna hardly ever slept. She'd be awake for hours. In the middle of the night, I would hear her moving around downstairs like a fitful ghost. I found her in her room. She was lying on her back, eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling. The older she got, the more she reminded me of Trina. It wasn't just how she looked. With the benefit of time, I could see some of my old friend's flaws in her, too. Trina had always been emotionally distant, someone who was willing to cut off the highs in order to never face the lows. Carl had confided in me a while back that Trina suffered from severe depression her whole life. I never knew about it. I didn't know if that could be passed down from mother to daughter, but Anna had clearly followed Trina's path. If you don't want to feel bad, then the safe thing is to feel nothing. Unlike me, who felt everything way too much. "Hey," I said to her. Anna didn't look at me. The one lamp in the room was dim and cast shadows. Her face was dark as she stared at the ceiling.
What do you want, Shelby? I'm tired.
I have something I thought we could look at together. I think you'll want to see it.
What is it?
I held up a plastic bag with a thumb drive inside. The FBI finally sent me what they recovered from Jeremiah's phone. I thought we could check it out on my computer.
No thanks.
Look, I know it'll be sad, but if there are pictures, don't you want to see them? It's the last little bit of Jeremiah we have. I thought it might make you feel close to him again.
I don't want to see any pictures.
All right, maybe later.
No, not later. I don't want to see them ever.
I shoved the thumb drive back in my pocket. I sat down next to Anna on the bed and stroked my fingers through her blonde hair. She didn't react at all. All I could feel from her was numbness. Is it really so hard to think about him? I said.
I don't think about him at all.
I don't believe you.
You can believe what you want. When people go, they're gone. Dwelling on it doesn't bring them back.
No, it doesn't. But forgetting them isn't any better. Anna closed her eyes.
I'm tired, Shelby.
All right. Good night. Try to get some sleep. I left her bedroom and closed the door softly behind me. I went to my own room and kept the lights off. I opened the window, letting in crisp spring air. Outside, the forest and the cemetery were lit up in a gray glow by the moon shining through misty clouds. I stood there for a while, watching the world. Spring was my favorite time of year, but my heart was heavy. I took the thumb drive from my pocket again. I felt as if I were holding Jeremiah's soul in my hand. I didn't want to wait until morning to see what he'd left for us. I booted up my computer and pushed the device into the USB slot. According to the note from Agent Reed, the FBI had recovered nearly 500 photos and a similar number of text messages from the boy's phone. This was like his last will and testament, his last chance to speak to us. I checked the texts first, which took me into the past. Jeremiah was alive again, and we were all more than 10 years younger. We'd lived the after of this case for so long that it was strange to be reminded of the before. I smiled as I read the texts. He'd messaged back and forth with his brother during the long summer days. He'd sent Adrian silly jokes, the kind little boys tell. What did the dog say to the tree? Bark. He'd exchanged texts with his mother, too. Ordinary things. What's for dinner? When do I have to be home? Yes, I took a shower. One of the messages broke my heart. It had been sent to Ellen 2 days after her father's funeral. Where did Grandpa go? Ellen texted back, Heaven. We talked about this, honey. He and Grammy are in heaven and they're happy, but they miss us just like we miss them. Jeremiah texted back, Okay. But I remembered that he was still wearing his Sunday suit when he disappeared. There were messages to his friends in the archive, but I was surprised to find only one message to Anna. The recovered texts went back for over a year prior to his disappearance. The boy hadn't deleted anything else on his phone, as far as I could tell, but at some point he'd erased his texts with Anna. They'd been best friends the previous summer, and I was sure they'd sent hundreds of messages back and forth to each other. But the texts were all gone. The only message that was left was a text that Jeremiah had sent to Anna in the early spring. It said, Are you still scared of the Ursulina? There was no reply. I closed out the messages, and I loaded the photographs. What I saw was the world through Jeremiah's 10-year-old eyes. He took photographs of everything. A rabbit in the middle of the yard, a June bug on a soccer ball, Cheerios spilled on the floor, Adrian playing a video game, his father napping in a hammock, a leaf, a doorknob. Most of the pictures were blurry because he never stood still long enough to focus. The photographs began that summer, but then they went backward in time to where Jeremiah was in school. I recognized dozens of students from different grades. Teachers I knew. Classes, desks, and blackboards inside the school building and everywhere, and the sprawling athletic fields outside. Click, click, click. I smiled at everything I saw. What stopped me was seeing a photograph of Keith Whalen. It was nothing unusual. It was simply a photo of Keith taking a drink of water from a hallway fountain. Jeremiah took plenty of pictures of random things, but I wondered why he'd taken that photograph. And then, as I scrolled through more pictures, I saw Keith again, getting out of his car in the school parking lot. And again, in the cafeteria. And again, grading papers at his desk in an empty classroom. All in all, I found almost 20 different pictures of Keith Whalen taken around the school grounds. That wasn't a coincidence. Jeremiah had been spying on him. When I located the earliest photograph of Keith in the picture gallery, I checked the date stamp, and it looked familiar to me. Jeremiah had taken the photo on the same day he'd sent his one remaining text message to Anna. "Are you still scared of the Ursulina?" I felt an odd sense of foreboding. A sense that something was very wrong. Around that same time in the roster of Jeremiah's photos, I began to see pictures of the Cairns, too. Whenever he built a tower of rocks near Black Lake on Keith's land, he took a picture of the stones. I found 8 different photographs taken over a span of several weeks. As soon as the winter snow had melted, he'd begun sneaking off to visit the lake and assemble his memorials. I began to scroll through the pictures more quickly. I knew something was waiting for me. There were only a handful of photographs taken during the winter. Mostly indoors, mostly in the boy's bedroom. His Lego creations. His boots. Crosses made with popsicle sticks. Christmas presents. The family Christmas tree lit up with lights. Picture by picture, I went back through each month. I found my finger hesitating with each click, as if I knew I would regret what I was about to see. And then there it was. One single photograph, date-stamped November 14th. Just one. There were pictures in the days before and after, but only one photograph was left on his phone from that day. I wondered if he'd deleted the others. It was a selfie. A nighttime selfie lit up by the flash. Jeremiah had stretched out his short arm to take the picture. I saw the familiar face of that happy, innocent boy, the face that had haunted us for a decade after he went missing. He had messy hair in need of a cut. One crooked tooth in his huge smile. But I wasn't focused on Jeremiah, because he wasn't alone in the selfie. No. He had his face pressed against the cheek of his best friend, who wore the same big, fearless grin that he did. They were 2 children off on an adventure. Hunting for the Ursulina. Jeremiah and Anna. She was with him. I recognized the background in the photograph. The 2 of them stood in front of the apple-red door of Keith Whalen's barn. The night of November 14th. The night Colleen had been killed. They both saw it happen. Chapter 48. Anna was gone. Her bedroom door was open. My first thought was, she knew. She knew I was going to find that picture. I rushed out of the bedroom to search for her, but my 6th sense made me turn around and go back inside. I felt an unspeakable horror in that room. I went directly to her dresser and ripped open the top drawer and threw the clothes inside onto the floor. I pulled out everything until the drawer was empty. It was gone. I knew she always kept it there, but it was gone. She'd taken her gun with her. I flew down the stairs in the grip of a desperate fear. Few things have ever scared me in my life, but I was terrified. The door to the backyard was ajar. She'd left it that way, as if knowing I'd follow her sooner or later. I pushed through the screen door onto the wet grass and screamed her name into the gauzy moonlight. Anna! The frogs croaked, the insects buzzed, but I heard nothing else. I saw the tracks of footprints leading through the grass past the gazebo, disappearing onto the cemetery path. I ran. When I reached the trees, I was blind because the moonlight couldn't penetrate the crown of the forest. I was crying, and I kept screaming her name. Anna! Where are you? I stumbled my way down the trail. Roots and rocks tripped me up. Branches and wet leaves slapped my face. The thunder of the frogs made me want to cover my ears. I broke free into one of the cemetery groves, where the sky opened up and the graves were bathed in silver light. It was empty except for the dead. Anna wasn't there. I made a silent plea to the people under the headstones to help me find her, but the ghosts had nothing to say. I was alone. I knew I could hunt for hours through the dark woods and never find her. She could be anywhere, and she wasn't answering when I called. But I kept going, running through the maze of trails, driven on by panic. Every time a branch cracked under my feet, I flinched because my mind was expecting a gunshot.
Anna!
I passed more graves silhouetted by the moon. Among the crosses and angels topping the stones, I saw a snowy owl observing me with silent grace. Somehow I'd expected it to be there. Every crossroad I faced was marked by an owl. It made me finally grasp the truth of what I'd been trying to understand my whole life. All those years ago, the owl that had called me to rescue a child hadn't come to me because of Jeremiah. The child who had needed me all along was Anna. God had rescued me for this moment. I'd been saved for tonight. Right now. This was why I was alive and not dead on the doorstep of my father's house. I kept running. I knew the path I was on. It was the path that led up and down the shallow hill where Anna and I had skied in the winter, past the diseased old beech tree we called Bartholomew, down into the hollow where Trina's grave was waiting for us. But not just Trina. Suddenly I knew why Anna was so reluctant to visit her mother, so unwilling to make her way into the small meadow with those silent spirits. It wasn't Trina she was afraid to see. Colleen Whalen was buried there too. The trail took me downhill. I ran with the wind pushing me faster and the moon guiding me toward the gap in the trees. I burst into the solemn meadow, and there she was. Anna was a motionless shadow standing in front of Colleen's grave. Her back was to me. The wind swirled her hair. I saw the pistol in her hand. Anna! She didn't turn around. Anna, put down the gun! I made my way carefully through the monuments, not wanting to alarm her. I passed Trina and put my hand on the angel adorning her grave, and I could feel something electric, like a voice that said, "Save her, Shelby." I glanced at the thickness of the forest surrounding us, and I could feel the hidden eyes of the owls. They were all watching us. Anna. We were only a few feet apart. I'd come around in front of her. Colleen's grave was between us, just a flat stone on the earth with the wet grass and weeds closing around it. Tears streamed down Anna's face along with the mist. A flood, a deluge of tears. Anna, tell me what happened that night with Jeremiah. She tried to talk, but her throat choked off the words. She shook her head back and forth and her whole body shivered. Please, tell me. Finally, she got the words out, and her voice begged for mercy.
It was my idea.
What was?
To find the Ursulina.
And why go to Keith Whalen's place to do that?
Because I was sure he was hiding it. He was the one who wrote the Halloween story. He knew so much about it. I told Jeremiah that he had to be keeping the Ursulina at his place.
So the two of you went over there that Saturday night.
Jeremiah didn't want to go. He was scared, but I made him go. I told him to sneak out of his room and meet me in the woods. And then we took the trail past Black Lake to Mr. Whalen's place.
What did you see there? Who did you see?
Nobody.
It's okay, Anna. None of this was your fault. Tell me what you saw. Was Keith there? Did you see Will and Vince? Who was it?
Nobody was there,
she moaned.
Just us.
Anna, I don't understand. What happened? She tried to tell the story through the tears.
I said we should search the barn. I said maybe he kept the Ursulina in there. I thought he would have it in a cage or something.
You went in the barn?
Yes.
What happened?
The Ursulina wasn't there. Nobody was there. Except I found...
What? What did you find? She tried to talk. She tried to say it, but she couldn't. Her whole body heaved with sobs. Her eyes squeezed shut and her face twisted with misery. Her head hung down against her neck.
A gun! I found a gun.
I nearly felt my legs collapse under me. I'd been wrong. So wrong. Oh, no. Oh, no, no. Oh, Anna.
Jeremiah said we should leave it, but I said, what if we saw the Ursulina? So I had it in my hand. And we left the barn, and it was so dark, and we couldn't see anything. We were near the big house.
I waited. I waited for the truth.
And there was this noise. Somebody was there. I couldn't see who it was, but I saw someone, and I was sure, I was sure. I was sure it was the Ursulina. I just pointed the gun at it, and I wasn't trying to fire or anything, but it went off. It went off. It was so loud. And Jeremiah was like, you got it. You got it, Anna. So we went to look, and there was this woman lying on the ground, and all this blood. I just dropped the gun, and we ran. Oh, God. I'm so sorry, Shelby. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do it. It just happened.
Oh, Anna. I thought of this girl, nursing her horrible secret day after day as she grew up. I thought of the weight of that one night crushing her for 10 years. I took a step toward her, toward Colleen's grave, but as I did, Anna lifted the pistol in her hand and placed the barrel at her temple. She could barely keep her hand steady. Anna, no. Put down the gun. Please. Put it down, honey. Don't do this. Do not do this.
I killed her. It's all my fault. Everything's my fault. All of it. Mrs. Whalen, Jeremiah, my mom. They sent Mr. Whalen to prison and I didn't say anything. I'm being punished. Don't you see that? I don't deserve to be alive.
That's not true. That's not true at all.
It is.
All I could see was the gun pressed against her forehead. Anna, listen to me. If Mrs. Whalen were standing here with us, she'd tell you it was an accident. She wouldn't blame you.
It doesn't matter. I killed her.
You have your whole life ahead of you. Don't throw it away. That's not what Colleen Whalen would want. That's not what your mother would want.
Her cancer came back right after. It was because of me. I did it.
It didn't matter what I said. She was determined to believe the worst of herself, and she wouldn't hear anything else. I didn't know what to do. In my head, I called for an owl to swoop down and knock the gun away from her hand, or for the ghosts to rise up and talk to her. I needed help. But it was just the two of us in the cemetery. This was up to me and no one else. Anna, look at me. Her red, lost eyes stared into mine. I could still see the child she'd been so long ago. Anna, give me the gun.
No. I can't live with this anymore.
I understand. I do. It hurts. It hurts so much. But what made it so hard was living with it all by yourself. You never have to do that again. You told me the truth. I'm here for you. I'll always be here. I'll always love you. Anna shook her head. I saw her finger slip over the trigger.
Don't you get it, Shelby? I murdered her.
Oh, Anna, honey, listen to me. You were 10 years old. She quivered where she was, her knees knocking together. I watched the gun, and I saw her finger twitch. We were at the brink of a cliff from which there was no turning back. She would stop, or she would fall. I rushed on, desperate to reach her. You said Jeremiah has been coming to your dreams for years. Why do you think he kept coming back? Why couldn't he rest in peace? It was because he wanted to save you. You need to listen to what he's been telling you all this time. You need to forgive yourself. Anna sobbed and gasped for air.
I miss him. I really miss him.
I know you do.
I miss Mom. I miss her so much.
Oh, honey, I know. I know. I took another step forward. Colleen's grave was under my feet. I reached across the stone and gently put my hand around the gun and pointed it at the ground and separated Anna's fingers from it. I took it into my own hand, laid it in the grass, and covered it with my foot.
I'm so sorry, Shelby.
Don't talk. Don't be sorry. It's over. It's all over. She wrapped her arms tightly around me and held on, her head crushed against my cheek. Around us, the gentle mist turned into rain and became a kind of music beating on the trees and the graves. We stood there for a long time. I listened to Anna sobbing as she let go of the past, and I stroked her hair and let her cry. Chapter 49. We all have to let go of the past. Either that, or it eats us alive. I was there when Keith Whalen was released from prison after the judge voided his conviction for murder. So was Anna. I was proud of her for that. She'd already testified in court about the night of November 14th, but she wanted to be there when Keith was set free to ask for his forgiveness. Like I expected, Keith gave it to her with no hesitation at all. He embraced her and let go of the 10 years he'd lost. He said he forgave me, too. I'm not so sure about that. We'll see what the future holds. He's moving back to everywhere to rebuild on his old land. I guess it doesn't matter if your home treats you badly. It's still home. Setting Keith free was the last chapter in Jeremiah's story. The ripples that had changed so many lives finally faded away into the lake. I found myself thinking about all the if-only moments that might have changed what happened. If only Paul Nadler hadn't escaped from the nursing home. If only the bus to Martin's Point had arrived 5 minutes earlier. If only Adam had called for help that night at the resort. If only, if only, if only. On and on. Jeremiah would be alive. Breezy would be alive. Adam would be alive. If only. But we all had to let it go. Ellen and Violet went back to Washington. I heard rumors that Ellen was planning to run for the Senate, and Violet was thinking of pursuing her congressional seat in the next election. I'll vote for them. Of course, I'll be pretty busy with my own campaign for sheriff. Yes, I'm going to run. The county board voted the money to clean up the ruins at the Middle Pines Resort once and for all and turn the land into the Jeremiah Sloan County Park. There will be a grand opening and ribbon-cutting ceremony next summer. I'm sure there will be more tears. Dennis Sloan got another DUI. Not everyone lets go in the right way. Will Gruder sent me his Medal of St. Benedict. I was right that it was actually the medal that had belonged to Keith Whalen. Anna had slipped it around her neck that night in the barn to ward off the Ursulina, and years later she gave it to Will. He asked me to return it to Keith. I did. Given Anna's age at the time of the shooting, she won't face any legal consequences, and I knew she had already punished herself enough in the years since it happened. She started therapy. She's got a long way to go, but at least she's on her way. Yesterday, she slept through the night for the first time in a long time, and Jeremiah didn't come to her in her dreams. In all these years of searching, no one has ever found the Ursulina. And me? I needed to let go of the past, too. My father's past. I didn't know what had happened the night after his mother died, and I had to make peace with the fact that I probably never would. After all, the past had already let go of him, and he had no more answers to give me. I confess that in a locked drawer of my office desk, I have a file where I've looked at maps and researched the distances someone might have traveled through a blizzard on a bitter night in January 35 years ago. It encompasses a universe of hundreds of town, county, and state police officers who might have rescued Sheriff Tom Ginn in a snowy campground. Maybe one of them was my birth mother, or maybe I just needed to believe she was out there for me to find. Last night I came home late. Monica and Dad were in the great room. Monica was tired and went to bed, but my father and I went outside to the gazebo in our yard, as we often do. I brought my guitar. It was a warm spring night. The moths beat their wings against the screens, and the humid air felt thick. We sat together, and Dad listened to me play. I'd been working on a song off and on for a while now. I finally had it done. I called it The Deep, Deep Snow, because it's about the secrets we keep and the places we hide them. The chorus goes like this. So we know, we know, we always know that what we did is under the snow. And we know that spring will show the thing we hid is down below. I sang it all from start to finish. When I was done, I put down my guitar in my lap and looked at my father with an embarrassed blush. Well, that's what it is. I know it's nothing special, but I like it.
It's beautiful,
Dad told me. Oh, I know it's not, but thank you. He shook his head and gave me that same amazing smile that I'd known my whole life.
I mean it. Play the song for me again. I could listen to you sing all night. You have such a pretty voice, young lady.
I smiled back at him. I pretended not to hear those words. Young lady. Sure, Dad, I replied, picking up my guitar. I'll play it again. You just close your eyes and listen.
This has been an Audible Originals production of The Deep, Deep Snow, written by Brian Freeman, performed by January Lavoie. Executive producers, David Blum, Steve Feldberg, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Edited and mastered by Brian Corcoran. Copyright 2019 by Brian N. Freeman. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.